my sister is beautiful, you know. Wilfred turned out to be just as Tom had described him. We immediately liked each other. He was impressed by my English, which I spoke better than him, and my distinguished academic record. Details of my childhood and life in the ghetto shocked him. For some reason, I gave my name as Mark. But how could people allow this to go on, Mark? He asked in a heavy German accent. In Germany, we read about apartheid. But what you tell me, we knew absolutely nothing about. I'm not surprised, I said. Not even the whites in this country know the truth about ghetto life. I can never live in this country, he said in disgust. But what a beautiful country. He paused and then said, It'll be my pleasure to have you play at my ranch. Maybe you can educate us about the reality we whites don't know but should know. Chapter 38. In November of 1973, the government finally allowed Arthur Ashe to set foot on South African soil. For almost 6 years, he had been persona non grata. The case against him was simple. He, a black man, had repeatedly impugned the government of South Africa and its policies of apartheid. But the straw which finally broke the camel's back was the remark Ashe supposedly made at a press conference in London, namely that he would drop the H-bomb on Johannesburg as a way of bringing the government to its senses. I don't think Arthur Ashe meant the remark to be taken seriously, I said to David one afternoon as we were reading the paper heralding Ashe's pending arrival. We had taken a break from tennis practice and were headed for the local cafe to get some cold drinks. He must have spoken it in anger. David was the number two singles player on the team, and he and I played number one doubles. He was a soft-spoken, politically sensitive, brilliant Zulu student whose love for the English language probably equaled my own. We frequently exchanged books, did English homework together, read prose and poetry together, trained together, and sat on the same seat during tennis trips. He was the first close friend I ever had. The one thing which differentiated us was that he was a womanizer, and I was not. I still clung to my secret formula. This bloody government is so damn sensitive to what black people say, David said, that it overreacts to everything they say. You know, I said in a whisper, if Arthur Ashe had been living in South Africa, he would have been immediately arrested for making that statement. Shipped him off to Robben Island is what the bastards would have done with him, David returned angrily. Or if they wanted, they would have allowed him to hang himself by his racket strings while under police custody. We broke out laughing, a nervous laughter, our eyes darting about to see if we were being watched. In a country where the writing of political slogans on walls was considered a serious crime, talking about political matters was tantamount to treason, punishable by hanging, if you were black. As David and I were talking, I remembered reading in newspapers about cases of black people mysteriously hanging themselves while under police custody. Black political activists were from time to time found dangling from belts, shirts, pants, blankets. At school, much of the furtive talk during lunch break was over such suicides, as the police labeled them. We called them cold-blooded murder. David's political awareness had come about, he said, largely because some of his distant relatives had been involved with the ANC, African National Congress, before the movement was forced underground and subsequently outlawed in the country. Because it was illegal for black schools to teach black political history, except tribal political history, which the government had concocted to suit the apartheid ideology, My friendship with David enlightened me a great deal about the ANC liberation movement. It was founded in 1912 by a group of black intellectuals, many of whom had studied in England and America. It began as a non-violent movement inspired by the work of Mahatma Gandhi, who lived in South Africa from 1894 to 1914, and it sought to peacefully bring about a South Africa free of racial prejudice. Its leaders believed that white South Africans could be persuaded on moral and humanitarian grounds to end segregation. But the National Party refused to end apartheid. Instead, each year the system was fortified by the promulgation of laws to entrench white rule and privilege. Black civil rights leaders continued to agitate, but the apartheid machinery ground on unheeding. Peaceful protesters were gunned down. Scores of civil rights leaders were arrested and sent to serve life sentences in the maximum security penitentiary on Robben Island, in the cold Atlantic Ocean. Among the prisoners were Nelson Mandela, Govan Mbeki, Walter Sisulu, and Robert Sobukwe. Those leaders who escaped went underground and continued their fight against injustice and racism. And because non-violent measures had failed, they took up arms, and Umkhonto weSizwe, Spear of the Nation, was formed. Yet they remained prepared to lay them down any minute to discuss the future of South Africa with whites. And their goal still was to establish a free and democratic South Africa where all people live in brotherhood and sisterhood, enjoying equal rights and opportunities. Despite the escalating black rebellion, the government still refused to talk. So it was that my generation was born into a decade of heightened conflict. And as the realities of apartheid became evident to many of us, as anger, hatred, and frustration became more and more a part of our daily lives, we began to look for ways of dealing with these destructive emotions. Those of us who knew about black liberation history and the ANC's part in it opted to emulate the Mandelas, the Mbekis, the Sisulus, and the Sobukwes, individuals who gave selflessly of themselves to the liberation struggle. Those of us who did not know black liberation history and the ANC's role in it still looked around for models to emulate. I was still looking when Arthur Ashe came to South Africa. His coming meant so much to blacks, who literally worshipped American blacks who proved they could triumph in a white man's world, a world that many of us believed was booby-trapped with all sorts of obstacles designed to sink blacks deeper into the mire of squalor and servitude, where white people wanted them to belong. The day Arthur Ashe arrived, I was on my way to the Barrett's Tennis Ranch. I had begun practicing there about 3 or 4 times a week. Wilfred, too, had the news of Ashe's arrival and seemed very excited about it. "I've seen him play in Germany," he said. "He's awesome. One of the best 7 volleyers in the world. And he's such a gentleman. The game couldn't have had a better ambassador. If he had been in politics, he would have made an excellent politician." "I would like to meet him," I said. "As a matter of fact, I already have tickets for us to go see him play." "I would like to meet him face to face." The words spilled out of my mouth. I was so emotional about wanting to meet Ashe that it did not occur to me that I was asking Wilfred the remotely possible. "Even with my contacts," Wilfred said, "there are things I can't do." The same week that Ashe arrived, another historic landmark was being established in the annals of South African sports. For the first time ever, a black man was to fight a white man in a boxing matchup hailed everywhere as the greatest breakthrough in sports apartheid since the government began allowing publication of photographs showing a black boxer pummeling a white boxer. In the past, such photos were banned as fomenting racial tensions. The boxing match pitted Bob Foster, a black American and the light heavyweight champion of the world, against a white challenger from South Africa. But I was no longer a boxing fan since that incident years ago. So when Uncle Petros, a boxing fanatic, obtained two scalped tickets and invited me along, I refused. The decision not to attend the fight was not based solely on my hatred of boxing. There was another, more compelling reason why I refused to go. And that reason had nothing to do with the senselessness or brutality of the sport. It had to do with one of the fighters, Bob Foster. I just didn't want to see the man. Why? I had begun to hate him. Since his arrival in the country, he had made various public statements that infuriated many black people. Statements like, he was in South Africa only to fight and not to engage in politics. Therefore, the press should stop hounding him for comments on apartheid. That he felt South Africa was not such a bad place after all. And he was thinking of someday building a vacation home here. What angered black people the most, however, was that he was trying his utmost to distance himself from us, as if we were subhuman blacks, wretches afflicted with some kind of racial leprosy that would rub off on him should he come into contact with any of us. By shutting himself in the white world and refusing to come to any of the ghettos, he was looked upon as a traitor and Uncle Tom. As far as I was concerned, he might as well have been another white man, a Boer preferably, for he seemed so hopelessly out of touch with reality, my reality, his reality. I pitied him and scoffed at all opportunities to see him fight. Instead, I concentrated all my efforts toward seeing Arthur Ashe. Though he, like Bob Foster, was a Negro and stayed, too, in the white world during his visit, his condemnations of apartheid made him one of us. He did not pretend he was a white man erroneously painted black. We blacks in South Africa looked up to and worshipped people like Ashe. We didn't feel, however, that each time black Americans came to our country, be they singers, athletes, or actors, they had to ignore or compromise what they had come for, mostly to make money, some to prop up floundering careers, and instead undergo some kind of penance by, for instance, staying in a shack in Alexandra or Soweto as a show of solidarity. We could care less if they stayed at the five-star hotels into which they were allowed as honorary whites, and which, after all, they could afford and seemed to generally prefer. All we wanted them to do was to be true to the realities of their color, to show concern for our plight, to not condone or appear to condone apartheid, to come out to the ghettos and meet us, because so few of us had the means to go see them perform. Also, we felt that because they were black Americans, they were in a safer position to criticize apartheid, something which was prohibitively dangerous for us to do, as shown by the conspicuous absence among us of people like them. I went to Ellis Park on a Tuesday, the first day of the tournament. Wilfred had a heavy load of tennis lessons and could not come with me, but he gave me money to cover expenses for the day. Arthur Ashe was scheduled to play his first round match in the afternoon. As I got off the black bus on North Street and was making my way toward the tournament site, I wondered what my first time attending a tournament full of world-class players would be like. The event was made even more significant by Arthur Ashe's presence, the first black man ever to play. The stadium was jam-packed. The few black people at the tournament, much to my surprise, mingled freely with whites. As the two groups walked about the courts, eagerly seeking autographs from the tennis stars. Arthur Ashe was favored to win his first round match against Sherwood Stewart, a bearded, lanky American from Goose Creek, Texas. The bleachers at Center Court were supposed to be fully integrated, but most black people kept to themselves, sitting in a cluster in the northeast section of the stands, an area without a canopy and fully exposed to the torrid Transvaal sun. I tried, along with a couple friends from Soweto, to integrate with a group of whites who looked as though they were from Pretoria. But the atmosphere became so tense that we abandoned the effort. We went back to the black section. Directly across from where we sat stood a large sign advertising a brand of Scotch whisky called Black and White. The sign read, "It's time to serve Black and White." There were two dogs, one black and one white, and a grandfather clock in the center of the picture. Arthur Ashe won his match in straight sets, 6-1, 7-6, 6-4. During the match, whenever he won a point, whether through hitting a winner or through an error by his opponent, the minority of black spectators ran to the stadium with clapping and cheering. I chuckled at catching subtle expressions of disdain on several white faces as a black man trounced a white man. Many white spectators, however, did root for Arthur Ashe. I wondered what would have been the situation had he been playing against a white South African. At the end of the day, as I was headed home in a packed black bus, the jubilation I had felt throughout the day waned. Stark reality once again overwhelmed me. Throughout the entire day at Ellis Park, I had been existing in a different world, a sort of make-believe world. I had breathed fresh air, walked on paved roads, mingled freely with white people, rested upon green grass and eaten free hot dogs given to me by whites. But as the packed bus rattled along Louis Botha Avenue, leaving behind the city of gold with its neon lights for a ghetto of darkness, smog, fear and violence. And all around me I saw sullen, worn, tired and sad faces of black workers. My spirit sunk. Sadly, I mulled over the day's events. Now that I had seen Arthur Ashe play, I found it hard to believe he was a black man. How could a black man play such excellent tennis, move about the court with such self-confidence, trash a white man and be cheered by white people? Am I being realistic? I asked myself as I hurried home amid choking smog and a fear of tsotsis. In thinking that I could ever be like him, or am I simply dreaming? How did Arthur Ashe get to be so good in a white man's sport? What miracles did the environment in America provide that nurtured blacks into great athletes like Arthur Ashe? Were the blacks in America really like us? Or was there something mixed up in their blood, maybe in their brains too, which made them capable of accomplishing prodigious feats, which seemed beyond the capability of even the best among us? I had read somewhere that there were among blacks in America singers, educators, politicians, mayors, inventors, scientists, actors, actresses, judges, army generals, pilots, writers, and so on. People whose names went African, yet some of whom were as black as I was. W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King Jr., Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Jesse Owens, Harry Belafonte, Marcus Garvey, Paul Robeson, Richard Wright, Sammy Davis Jr., Nat King Cole, Lena Horne, Booker T. Washington, James Baldwin, Jesse Jackson, Sidney Poitier, Duke Ellington, George Washington Carver, Malcolm X, Marian Anderson, Ralph Bunche, Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall, Ella Fitzgerald, Eldridge Cleaver, Langston Hughes, Louis Armstrong, and the list went on and on. I came across these names in newspapers, magazines, and books. On reading of their accomplishments, I found it beyond me to believe that they, whom history depicted as descendants of slaves, slaves taken from the very Africa in which I lived, could have achieved so much. We in South Africa had never been called slaves, though all along, day in and day out, we had been treated worse than slaves. None of our ancestors, as far as I could tell from our distorted history, had ever been shackled and considered chattel, bred and traded like cattle, as the ancestors of the American black had been. Yet somehow, in a mysterious, diabolical way, our growth as a people, our aspirations as individuals, our capacity to dream and to create, our hopes for the future as a nation united, had been ruthlessly stunted by whites who possessed our lives from birth to death. It seemed as if the haunting belief held firmly by many a white South African, especially advocates of white supremacy, that we blacks were an inferior race, denied by nature and by God the ability to achieve anything great, was being affirmed as years went by without a single person attaining any measure of success that could be termed prodigious by worldwide standards of excellence. Yes, we had a few writers, singers, educators, actors, actresses, and so on. But few had attained the international stature of their American counterparts. Could I ever be like Arthur Ashe? Gradually, I became aware that I could never be like him, for as long as I remained in South Africa. For reasons still unclear, America, the land that had given birth to Ashe and nurtured him, loomed bright as the place to go to realize my fullest potential in tennis. In life, there it seemed blacks who had the talent, the will, the resiliency, the ambition, the drive to dream were turning their dreams into reality. I kept returning to Ellis Park to watch him play, to study his mannerisms, and to weigh his attacks on apartheid. I even skipped school expressly to see him. He continued his winning streak. The results made headlines in all the black newspapers. Blacks all over the country rejoiced, including those who knew nothing about tennis. Arthur Ashe's triumphs on the court were becoming triumphs for the black race. His name was everywhere, in stores, in schools, in churches, in shebeens, in the madam's kitchen and garden. Every day I asked my mother to request a special prayer at her church for Arthur Ashe to win the tournament. I do not know why I did that, considering I was skeptical about religion. I must have wanted Ashe to win so badly that I felt all powers known to men had to be on his side. Presumably, Arthur Ashe knew that the success of his mission to South Africa would be measured not by the amount of his criticism of apartheid, but by how well he did in the tournament. If he were to win it, which, considering the way he was playing, was conceivable, then he would have proven that blacks had the ability to succeed, if allowed the opportunity. If, however, he were to lose, say to some white South African, then the myth of black inferiority would remain entrenched in the minds of whites, and it would become doubly hard, if not impossible, for black athletes to break down racial barriers. One afternoon I followed a throng of spectators to a tent on a patch of green next to Centre Court. Arthur Ashe was scheduled to make an appearance. I tried to get to the front of the tent so I could hear him speak, from close up, but a multitude of white people, school children, adults, and news people mobbing him for autographs and comments prevented me. Though I was some distance away, I could still hear snippets of his speech. His English sounded strange, heavily accented. He was so eloquent that white women giggled in admiration. It was as if he were talking through his nostrils. After answering reporters' questions for a while, he left for a waiting car. I marveled at how proudly he walked. I had never seen a black man walk that proudly among whites. He appeared calm, cool, and collected, even though he was surrounded by a sea of white faces. One thing I found remarkable about Arthur Ashe was that he was not afraid to dismiss questions from white people if he considered them worth ignoring, and say what he considered important. I had never seen a black person do that unless he or she was mad or something. You answered everything the white man asked and more. Toward the end of Arthur Ashe's first week in South Africa, a story appeared in the World that he would be conducting a tennis clinic in Soweto. Several white South African players, among them Ray Moore, had volunteered to help him. Ray Moore was an interesting fellow, an avowed critic of his government's policies of apartheid, especially in sports. He was typical of South African liberals, who from time to time found themselves torn between conscience and patriotism. He was unequivocally opposed to racial segregation, yet he led an all-white South African team to its first ever Davis Cup victory, won by default when the other finalist, India, refused to play in protest of apartheid. Young black tennis players from all over the Southern Transvaal were invited to take part in the clinic. But I was overlooked, though I was unarguably the best junior player in Alexandria. The reason? Petty township politics and jealousy. Apparently, selectors of participants in the clinic left me out because of my association with the Barrett's Tennis Ranch. I was disappointed but decided to go to Soweto anyway, for I wanted to see Arthur Ashe once again. He had made such a big impression on me that I hoped this time to get near enough to ask him a few questions about America. I did not have train fare. Will Ferret gave me a couple rands. He had now become my unofficial tennis sponsor. From time to time he gave me money to enter tournaments and travel to them, gave me tennis clothes, rackets and balls, and once in a while he would buy me a school book or help my family through hard times. And he did it all out of the goodness of his heart, without any trace of condescension or paternalism. It was the knowledge that white people like him existed that reinforced my belief that though whites in South Africa were generally prejudiced toward blacks, and in many cases treated us as less than dogs, there were among them those handful who would bend over backwards to help black people, not as servants, but as equals. Such whites are the only hope for South Africa. The more their numbers increase, the better the chances for peaceful change. The train ride to Soweto was a living nightmare. People dangled from windows and from the top of the train because the coaches were packed. In the coach I was in, a sickly black baby girl of about 6 months, strapped loosely in a cloth slung to her mother's back, was being crushed by the masses of black bodies packed like sardines, leading its mother to cry, "Stop killing my baby!" "Why did you bring the damn thing here?" someone retorted. Meantime, on the opposite tracks, trains for white people passed by, almost empty except for an occasional passenger relaxing on one of the cushioned seats, feet hung on the opposite, unoccupied seat. Two black youths were electrocuted while riding on top of the train when it reached Krisa Station. Two more have bit the dust, said an old man. But why do they do it? Asked a short, jet black man, obviously a stranger to Soweto. Where will they ride? Replied the old man. They could wait for other trains. With this one so packed, surely there's bound to be a roomy, if not empty, one shortly. Are you mad, brother? Said the old man. There's never a roomy or empty train to Soweto. You think this one is packed? Wait till you see it during morning and evening rush hour, and during weekends. Then people get zapped not only when they're on top, but as they dangle from windows too. Others get crushed underneath. Wait till then, brother, and you'll sing a different song. The stranger to Soweto shook his head in disbelief. I arrived at my destination without further incident. As I made my way toward the tennis courts, however, I saw a man being robbed and murdered in broad daylight by a gang of Tsotsis. I backtracked and took the long way to the courts. When I reached the two potholed courts with tattered nets and broken fences, I found assembled about them the largest crowd of black people I had ever seen about a tennis court. As I made my way through the thick crowd, a one-eyed drunkard blocked my way and hiccuped. Sipo is here, brother. Who's Sipo, brother? I asked. Don't you know him, brother? The man mumbled. He's one of us. Who's one of us? The one from America, said the drunkard, and he staggered away. The one with the afro, he said over the shoulder. So Arthur Ashe was considered a gift. Sipo is Zulu for gift. A savior. He had become the black messiah sent from strange shores to come liberate us. By attacking apartheid in a way no other black American entertainer or athlete had done, Arthur Ashe did appear to be a sort of messiah. To me, it seemed he had come expressly to reveal some previously hidden truth about what we black people can accomplish. A truth on which to focus my life, hopes, and dreams. The difference between him and me, I deduced from that truth, was that he had risen above his suffering, that he had conquered his fear of the white man, that he had learned to beat white people at their own game. I knew that if my desire was, and to the umpteenth time it was, to reach where Arthur Ashe had been, then I too had to rise above my suffering. I too had to conquer my fear of the white man. I too had to learn to beat white people at their own game. I had to believe in myself and not allow apartheid to define my humanity. Somehow, deep inside, I felt that I was on the right track, that it was simply a matter of time before something happened to make my dreams come true. I don't know why I felt that way. Again, I could not make it close to Arthur Ashe. I circled around the courts a couple times, desperately looking for an opening. There was none. I resigned myself to standing at the back of everyone. Near where I stood, a group of young black demonstrators began to gather. A few carried placards, the wording of which I couldn't distinguish. Go home, Arthur Ashe, go home, one of the demonstrators cried. We love you, brother, but go home. We admire all you've done, but go home. We don't need you here, for your presence legitimizes the system. Go home, brother, and leave us alone. You're doing more harm than good by coming to South Africa. Tell the same to the brothers and sisters in America. Amid the heckling and the jarring noise of passing trains, I tried to listen to what Arthur Ashe was saying through a megaphone. I couldn't hear a thing. In a desperate attempt to convince myself that I had heard him say something, because I dared not face up to the possibility, which was slowly becoming a reality, of having to leave without getting near him. I imagined him as having said the following militant speech. "Don't give up the struggle, brothers and sisters. Don't give up. Stay united. Fight hard on all fronts. And some day soon you shall all be free. Your brothers and sisters throughout Africa have become free. Millions more are becoming free every day. The drums of Uhuru, freedom, cannot be stopped. The die is cast. Someday soon, apartheid will be no more, and democracy will prevail. One man, one vote will be the rule. In the meantime, learn to use the white man in the same way as he uses you. Above all, unite, brothers and sisters, for in unity lies your strength. Don't allow the enemy to divide you. Unite and fight for what you and the rest of the world believe is right, just. Truth is on your side, the numbers too. It's only a matter of time before the struggle is won." There was no doubt that what Ashe had really said had come nowhere close to the militant speech I attributed to him. But emotionally, I believed that he had said the militant speech, and that I was able to hear it through some sort of ESP. So, when I left for the train station, I was glad I had made the nightmarish trip to Soweto. Arthur Ashe lost in the finals to Jimmy Connors. The match was a thriller. Arthur Ashe played like a man possessed. And had Connors not been at his best, Ashe would have been crowned the champion. Despite the loss, Ashe's trip to South Africa was not in vain. He won the doubles with Tom Okker, a Dutchman, thus becoming the first black man in the history of tennis in South Africa to have his name enshrined among those of whites, for future generations to mull over its significance or lack of it. During his final days in the country, Arthur Ashe met with high-ranking government officials and urged them to abolish apartheid in sports, or else the rest of the world would continue boycotting South African teams. One paper quoted him as warning whites to start extending equal rights to blacks in all spheres of life because time was running out, black patience was becoming exhausted, and black moderates were turning into radicals and revolutionaries. Arthur Ashe left an enduring monument in South Africa. He established the Black Tennis Foundation, BTF, along with Owen Williams, a white liberal who ran professional tennis in the country, and one of the persons instrumental in bringing Arthur Ashe to South Africa. The BTF was funded by some of the country's major corporations and was administered by a multiracial body of officials. Its mission was to make the game of tennis accessible to every black child in South Africa, from the cities and from the tribal reserves, who wanted to play tennis but had no resources to do so. I began working even harder at my game because a few youngsters in Alexandra saw me as someone worth emulating. How I wished to succeed in tennis so that they would really have something to emulate. For the first time, I told Scaramouche my dream of gaining passage to America through tennis, and he urged me to write to Arthur Ashe. "You think he'll answer back this time, Oom?" Afrikaans for uncle. "Scarry?" I asked. I had already through the BTF, written one letter and got no reply. I jotted down an emotional 10-page letter detailing the reasons why I felt I was worthy of a tennis scholarship. I again sent it through the BTF. Again, there was no reply. My hopes of ever going to America fizzled. I continued teaching 6, 7, and 8-year-olds the little I knew about tennis, with the hope that they might someday succeed where I had failed. But the obstacles facing them were many, almost insuperable. They had no rackets, no balls, no decent tennis courts, no shoes. All they had was the determination, courage, and resiliency so typical of African children. Because of all the tennis work I was doing in the township, some of the people who hated me for playing tennis at the ranch began acting friendly, even going to the extent of telling me to let sleeping dogs lie. But there were those whose hatred and jealousy were implacable. These continued to call me an Uncle Tom and to threaten me with death. I therefore was careful never to travel alone, to always keep in the open, to curtail my trips to the ranch and to do everything not to give them reason to carry out their threats. I guess I could have appeased them by simply staying away from white tennis players, but that I was not prepared to do. I somehow felt that my only chance to make something of myself depended very much on my cultivation of genuine friends among whites, who, after all, had the means to help me in times of need. Also, I had come a long way from my days of fear, hatred, ignorance, and stereotypes to turn back. Chapter 39. In 1974, 2.5 years after I began tennis, I won my first championship, the Alexandra Open, defeating David in the final. The trophy became my most prized possession. I became the talk of the school, and teachers pointed to me as a student who mixed sports and studies well. When I took the trophy to the ranch, Wilfred was full of praise. "I wish I had been able to see you play," he said. He had been refused a permit to enter the ghetto. My trophy was prominently displayed in the bar, and whites were so full of praise and encouragement to win more that I felt saddened that most black children did not have the opportunities to learn about different whites as I did. "So Wilfred's lessons are paying off, huh?" said a short German fellow with whom I played from time to time. "Yes, Wolfgang," I said. "I hope you'll be able to keep up the next time we play." Many whites at the ranch had accepted me as an individual, an equal, that I called them by their first names, instead of "bus," and could joke with them. That was unheard of in many parts of South Africa. "Soon we'll have to start a fund for you to play in all the big tournaments overseas," said Wolfgang. "Think you'll win Wimbledon someday?" "As long as they keep on practicing with you," I said, laughing. "I don't stand a ghost of a chance." He laughed. I served him liquor. He bought me a large glass of Coca-Cola. We exchanged banter, sitting at the same table. Thinking that I could be jailed for such behavior if the police were ever to get wind of it did not prevent me from being spontaneous. "You've already crossed the Rubicon," I told myself. Of course, this cheery view of life ended each day at the threshold of the ranch. Beyond, I was subjected to the same dehumanizing laws as any black. I came to develop a dual personality. And in the beginning, I could switch from one to the other as the situation warranted. Gradually, however, like Jekyll and Hyde, one personality began to predominate. I could no longer pretend, fawn, or wear the mask of civility without my true self violently rebelling. I knew that I had to find a safe way to be myself without breaking the law, or else I would surely go mad. One afternoon I returned home from school and was preparing to leave for tennis practice when my mother, who had been away all day, burst through the door crying, "I've been saved, child. I've truly met the Church of God and His messengers." My reaction was, "Oh hell, here we go again." But I went ahead and listened. My mother proceeded to tell me about her meeting that afternoon on the bus from work with members of the 12 Apostle Church of God, who subsequently proselytized her to their religion. The church, she said, was like no other she had ever come across. "These people prophesy," she said animatedly. "They have the gift of tongues, just like the apostles in Jesus' time." "Ma," I said, "can't you ever learn not to be taken in by quacks? Can't you ever learn, huh? Everyone will profess anything to make money. There's no such thing as speaking in tongues, and you know it. Probably all it is some gibberish someone cooked up to fool people like you and make money doing it. I thought you were smarter than that, Ma." "This is no gibberish, child," my mother insisted. "I've heard gibberish before. These people are for real. God has inspired them. What's more, they demand no money from anyone. All they say is that you have to become convinced of the power of God in your own good time. And child, the power of God is with these people. I've never seen a happier group. I'm going to become part of them." "Well, do what you want," I said. "It's your life." A week after my mother switched churches, her employer in Randburg, a suburb of Johannesburg, had her registered and given a work permit. How this came about, after all the years her application had been denied, I will never know. As if this weren't miraculous enough, she also found two other washing jobs the same week. My mother was quick to point out that God had a hand in all this. The 12 Apostle Church of God had such influence on her that she not only attended Sunday morning and evening hour-long services, but went to choir practice on Tuesdays, hour-long services on Wednesdays, and Thursday afternoon, her day off, she and other members went about the township visiting the sick and bringing more sheep to the fold. The house became a pulpit. Everyone who passed through our house had to be told about my mother's God. Her new God turned her into a believer that every problem was solvable, every obstacle surmountable. She never got angry or wished anyone ill or hated her enemies, for she believed that her all-loving God would not approve of such emotions. Even her criticism of my father lessened. She tolerated every abuse he hurled at her. She even gave him money. She loved to share the little she had and would often bring home complete strangers off the streets. Tramps, prostitutes, lunatics, and even tzotzis, and would share with them whatever little food was there. And occasionally, she would let them sleep over for a night or two. "Are you going mad, Mama?" I said to her one day as she came in with a crazy, filthy woman whose rags teemed with lice. The inside of her legs were lined with dried urine, and she smelled of shit. "Isn't she a human being like you and me?" my mother asked, and proceeded to prepare a meal for the crazy woman who, meantime, kept scratching herself till she bled. She was sitting so close to my bed that I asked her to move away for fear that the vermin that were eating her might invade it. She laughed childishly and moved closer to the bed, almost touching it. I was enraged. "Mama, tell this bloody woman to move away from my bed or else?" My mother asked her politely, and she complied. As they were eating out of the same bowl, my mother told her about God and how he could work miracles for those who believed in him with all their hearts and accepted him as their personal savior. "Do you know that God can cure you if you believe in him with all your heart?" my mother asked the crazy woman, who replied by laughing and saying something in baby talk. She seemed more concerned with devouring the food. Shrugging aside the fact that the sermon was falling on deaf ears, my mother continued preaching in earnest, as if the crazy woman were the most attentive of listeners and on the verge of being converted. I felt utter disgust. I stood up and left, wondering if indeed my mother was mad. Was the burden of black life finally muddling her brain? I could not face the possibility of an insane mother. Yet each day, the more she became closer to her God, the stranger her behavior became. So strange that some neighbors publicly called her a lunatic. Concern for my mother's mental health led me to decide to go to her church and find out exactly what was going on there. If there was anything fishy going on, I would denounce it. The church was a zinc structure with wooden pews. The congregation was diverse: Zulus, Sotus, Tsongas, Xhosas, and coloreds. As I chatted with several members before services began, I was struck by how similar their demeanor was to my mother's. They were passionate about their God, optimistic about the future, and patient to the point of disgusting me. Saints and angels could not have behaved any better. They laughed and smiled a lot, as if the world had no sadness or tears. They greeted each other as brother and sister. The church hierarchy consisted of a priest whose duties included interpreting dreams. Below him were 11 male deacons who helped in the running of the church. During services, they sat behind the priest. After several hymns, the priest fell into a long prayer. Suddenly, my mother, sitting in the front pew, leaped and let out a half scream, which died as suddenly as it began. I stared at her in amazement, wondering what she was about. The priest stopped right in the middle of the prayer and extended his right arm in the direction of my mother, who then started speaking in tongues. I could not make out what she was saying, except that the voice was simply not hers. It had the gurgling sound of someone being choked. As she spoke, her limbs shook like an epileptic's. Her pupils dilated. She seemed locked in a deadly combat with a sinister force. She prophesied for 5 minutes or so and then stopped, sweating as though she had been running a marathon, her face drained of all expression. Two women nearby fanned her with their handkerchiefs and set her down. My youngest sister, whom my mother had been suckling when the force hit her, was returned to her by Flora, who was sitting alongside. The priest proceeded to interpret my mother's prophecy, but I was too anxious about her well-being to pay any attention to what he was saying. Directly after he finished the interpretation, two other women began speaking in tongues too. What they said was as unintelligible as my mother's gibberish. They too experienced the same physical symptoms as she. Again, the priest offered interpretations, which were as meaningless to me as if he too were speaking in tongues. I left the church as confused as I had entered it. But one thing was certain. My mother wasn't insane. She could, in some mysterious way, communicate with her God. But I knew I could never have her kind of faith. I could never believe as deeply in a God who seemed oblivious to the pain of blacks and seemed to favor whites. For suffering had made me, at too young an age, too dependent upon my own free will. Chapter 40. In June of 1975, I was chosen to represent the Southern Transvaal Black Junior Tennis Squad in the national tournament in Pretoria. I was the first player chosen from Alexandra. The thought of competing against top black juniors from all over the country led me to overtrain, and I ended up doing poorly in the individual competition. But I helped Southern Transvaal win the team trophy. The 2 weeks in Pretoria opened my eyes fully to the stark realities of black tennis. All the junior players I talked to, from as far away as Natal, the Orange Free State, and Cape Province, echoed the same problems: poor facilities, lack of tennis equipment, sponsorship or qualified coaches. As long as apartheid remained the way of life, I saw no future for me in black tennis. This realization made me even more thankful that I had access to the tennis ranch. Wilfred was by no means the best white coach in the land, but he was better than all the black coaches put together. And the ranch facilities were superior to anything black children ever dreamed of having access to. Under his tutelage, I knew I could afford to have dreams about tennis, about life. Without him, I would most likely have ended up along one of those dead-end roads many black youngsters found themselves on. A week or so after I came back from the national tournament, my eyes began to hurt. At first, I paid little attention to the pain, attributing it to fatigue. I had had many ailments in my life, from sore teeth to migraines to pneumonia. But because medical attention was sought only in life and death situations by many blacks, I had simply waited for nature to take its course. I did the same with my sore eyes. They got worse. They swelled and ached to the point where I could hardly read or keep them open for long, especially in light. My mother became alarmed. Everyone suspected witchcraft. "The swines," my mother said when I told her I feared going blind. I had even stopped going to school. "They couldn't get at you any other way, so they went for your eyes. They've bewitched you, child." I was amazed. "But I thought you were a Christian," I said to my mother. "Being a Christian doesn't make voodoo stop existing." "I don't think I've been bewitched," I said. "There must be some rational explanation to the whole thing. As soon as I have enough money, I'll go to the clinic and have doctors check me." 3 weeks later, on a Friday, my mother gave me part of a monthly wage, and I went to the clinic. I found the place overcrowded with black women, men, children seeking treatment for all kinds of diseases and injuries. I waited on the long line. It became afternoon. Still, I was not attended to. By the time I was through with the paperwork, many doctors had gone, and those that remained were giving priority to emergency cases. Apparently, the fact that I was going blind was not considered an emergency. There were dying people around me. I returned on Monday. There was no outpatient service on weekends, and the story was the same. Even worse because it was following a weekend. "Ma," I said when I returned without receiving treatment, "maybe I ought to go and see a specialist." A few white doctors were allowed to practice in the ghetto, but only the wealthy could afford to go to them. "That would mean going a month without food," she said. "Why don't you go to Tembisa Hospital or Baragwanath? I can at least give you bus fare." I went to Tembisa Hospital, which was 2 hours away by bus. Baragwanath was 4 hours away. What I found at Tembisa Hospital was even worse than at Alexandra Clinic. There was a long waiting list of emergency cases. I was told to come back in about a week's time, as my case was not a matter of life and death. At this point, my eyesight was as good as a blind man's. "Child," my mother said, "let me take you to the witch doctor before it's too late." I agreed. The following day, we took a 3-hour bus trip to Hammanskraal, a rural ghetto outside Pretoria, there to see what my mother described as the greatest diviner in the country. She was a short, fat woman with long strands of hair braided with red clay. A blown goat's bladder was tied to the end of one strand of hair. Beads and bones circled her neck, and copper and silver bangles her arms. Her face was caked with yellow mud. She was draped in goat skin. After introduction ceremonies, my mother, the diviner, and I went to a hut, where we sat on mats on the floor, opposite the diviner, as she arranged her divining bones and shells. My mother asked the diviner to tell us why we were there. This was supposed to be a test of the diviner's powers. The diviner took the array of bones and shells in her fat hands, shook them, muttering incantations, then threw them on the mat in front of her. She carefully watched the bones and shells roll and come to a stop. She stared at them as in a trance. I simply could not believe what happened next. She began telling me my life story with such accuracy, from childhood all the way to the present, that all I could do was gasp. Things that I had done but forgot came to life as she unraveled my past. Some of these things nobody but myself knew. "Am I dreaming?" My mind reeled. I sought rational explanation for what seemed the supernatural. Had my mother told her about me? No, she couldn't have. I had been with her all the time. Besides, there were many events that the diviner mentioned that even my mother knew nothing about. The diviner gave the diagnosis of my ailment. "Several individuals," she said, "some of them distant relatives, were implacably jealous of my successes in school. Because these people dared not kill me, for my ancestors were jealously protecting me, they had resorted to doing the next best thing to murder, blind me." Naturally, with my Western education, I found such an explanation preposterous. I decided to test the diviner. "How are they bewitching me?" I asked. "Even though that question is to test me," the diviner said, making me start, "to set your mind at ease, I'll answer it. But remember this, I can read all your thoughts." After a minute's silence, she said, "Set aside the white man's bifocals for a moment. See the world according to eyes native to you. Don't attempt to explain what I say or do the white man's way, for you will not understand. Be a son of Africa, and you'll understand. She again paused. Then, after staring at me for such a long time that I thought I was naked, she said, in the voice of someone in a trance, "They've been doing it all along, and they are doing it now, these children of hell, and they'll continue to do it until they achieve their aim, if they are not stopped." She paused. "You write letters.